It's him against the pack now. Richard Tew drives away without feeling evil, merely pragmatic. A man like Tima Renews can affect the way people vote in elections. Tew needs to give him something in exchange. The only thing Tima cares about is his standing area in the rink. Richard Tew can't give that back to him unless it's been taken away from him first. Anna doesn't set out through the door with the intention of hurting anyone. She just can't bear to stay in the house. She doesn't even mean to follow Benji through the forest. She just happens to catch sight of his white top ahead of her through the trees. He's walking slowly, as if his feet hadn't quite reached agreement with the rest of his body. Anna is good at tracking animals. It's an instinct. So she follows him. Perhaps she just wants to know where Benji's going, if he's on his way to see a girlfriend. She manages to tell herself that it might feel easier then, if she sees him with someone 10 divisions more attractive than her. The forest soon becomes dark, but she follows the red glow of his cigarette and the sweet smoke he leaves behind him. Halfway between Beartown and Hid, he turns off and follows a track down to the campsite. He stops at one of the cabins, knocks on the door. Anna recognizes the man who opens it. He's a teacher at school. Afterward, Anna won't remember what she thought or felt when she watches Benji wrap his body around the man's and kiss him. It's easy to blame Anna for everything she does now. She's in pain, but perhaps everyone is. She's never felt more alone, and loneliness drives everyone to make bad decisions, but perhaps none more than 16-year-olds. She pulls out her phone and takes pictures of Benji and the teacher. Then she posts the photographs online. And all hell breaks loose.
Chapter 31. Darkness. Bang. We always speak of secrets as if they're personal possessions. My secret. But they're that only for as long as they remain out of other people's reach. We can't almost lose them, just altogether or not at all. As soon as they slip out into the world, they become an earthquake, an avalanche, a tsunami. It may take only a single rash comment, a fleeting thought, or some photographs posted online by someone with a wounded heart, but that sets the stones rolling and the snow loses its grip, and the wall of water becomes insurmountable before we realize how it happened, and from then on it's impossible to hold everything back. Like capturing the scent of July and trying to hold it in your cupped hands. Everyone knows now. Everyone knows what no one was supposed to know. Benji is woken up by it. Bang. One single bang, but so hard that the walls of the cabin shake. Then silence. The teacher rolls over sleepily in bed, but Benji is already out of the bedroom, crouching down as he heads toward the door. He doesn't know why, but afterward he will remember that he was already filled with dread. He knew this was idiotic when he first arrived, when they kissed in the doorway. One day he'll figure out that it was because he was in love. That's why he wasn't more cautious. He opens the door of the cabin, peers out, but whoever is waiting in the darkness doesn't make him or herself known. He's on the point of turning and going back inside when he sees where the noise came from. Bang. Like the sound of a puck hitting a wall, or a heart thudding against a ribcage, or a knife being embedded in the wood of a cabin door on a campsite. A plain piece of paper. 3 letters. The one in the middle is A, and the triangle at the top of the letter is where the knife has been driven through into the wood. F-A-G. Anna wanders around in the forest as if she were in a fever. The snow is falling fast, early, and deep this year, even for this part of the country. An autumn storm is on its way in. It's so easy to underestimate the power of the cold, how quickly it can kill you. It's a soft-spoken murderer whispering that you can sit down and rest for a while if you're tired, tricking you into thinking you're sweating, encouraging you to take your clothes off. Snow and freezing temperatures can summon up the same hallucinations as blazing sun in a desert. Anna knows all that because she's more at home in the forest than the town. More squirrel than human, as Maya usually teases her. When Anna is among trees, she leaves reality behind, time stops, and what happens here could never affect life in town. That's what she's always liked to imagine, and that's why the full impact of what the hell she's just done doesn't hit her until she's almost home. Only when she reaches the door of her dad's house does the panic hit her, hard and brutal, and her chest hurts so much that she's left short of breath. It's so easy to think that what we post online is like raising your voice in a living room, when it's actually more like shouting from the rooftops. Our fantasy worlds always have consequences for other people's realities. Anna pulls out her phone and deletes the pictures of Benji and the teacher, but it's too late. She's already spread their secret like ash across the sea, and it can never be taken back. Our spontaneous reactions are rarely our proudest moments. It's said that a person's first thought is the most honest, but that often isn't true. It's often just the most stupid. Why else would we have afterthoughts? Peter bangs on the door of the bearskin early in the morning. Ramona opens a window in the apartment upstairs, wrapped in a dressing gown and a lot of anger. "You'd better hope the bar's on fire, lad, waking decent folk at this time of day." But she relents because Peter was a boy too, once upon a time. She called him so many times to come and take his drunk father home that Peter himself has hardly touched a drop since. His whole life has been shaped by the fact that he tries to mend everything, make everyone happy, hide other people's mistakes, take responsibility. He confesses, "There's going to be a press conference, Ramona. The factory's getting new owners, foreigners. They're the club's mysterious sponsor that everyone's been talking about, and I'm going to have to stand there and tell the reporters I'm going to get rid of the standing area and get rid of the hooligans." It's possible that Ramona is shocked, but if she is, she doesn't let it show. She lights a cigarette. "What's that got to do with me?" Peter clears his throat. "They're going to let me handpick one board member. Anyone I like. I'm sure Tails will be excellent," Ramona snorts. "Tails would rather it was you." "So would I," Peter replies. A little puff of smoke emerges from one of Ramona's nostrils, the only indication that she's surprised. "Have you been hit in the head, lad? You know I... Given what you want to do to Tima and the boys, they're my boys. That standing area is... It's their damn club, too." Peter stands there straight-backed, even if his voice gives up. "I'm doing everything I can for the good of the club, but I've been told that no one surrenders power voluntarily. So if I'm really going to try to convince myself that I'm doing this for unselfish motives, I need to put someone on the board who won't always agree with me. Someone who'll fight me." Ramona goes on smoking quietly. "If we both fight for what we believe in, then one of us will be out of a job at the end of it." Peter nods. "But if we both fight for the club's best, the club will win." Ramona ties her dressing gown tighter, thinks for a long time. Then she frowns. "Are you having breakfast?" "What sort?" Peter asks. Ramona grunts. "I probably got some coffee somewhere, or whatever it is you teetotal types drink." That's how Ramona gets a seat on the board of Beartown Ice Hockey. But the two are interrupted before they have time to finish the discussion. Peter's phone rings first. It's Tails asking, "Have you heard about Benjamin?" That's how Ramona finds out. She will bear the shame of her reaction for the rest of her life, as will Peter, because their very first thought is, "Not this too." Our spontaneous reaction is often our most stupid. Finding out the truth about people is like a fire, destructive and indiscriminate. The truth about Benji burns through Beartown and Hied, and everyone who has ever had the slightest reason to be jealous of him or dislike him can see a crack in his armor now. They stick their knives in as hard as they can, every last one of them. Few people would have dared to say anything to Benji face to face, So they do what people always do. Talk about him, not with him. He needs to be dehumanized, turned into an object. There are 1,000 ways of doing that, but there's none simpler than the one we almost always use. Taking his name away from him. So when the truth spreads, people don't write Benjamin or Benji on their phones or computers. They write the hockey player, or the school pupil, or the young man, or the queer. Some will later claim that they don't hate homosexuals, they just hate Benji. Many of them will claim that we were just surprised that he, of all people. Some will suggest that if there'd been any sort of sign, it might have been handled better. Some will offer complex cultural analysis suggesting that the world of sports, and the hockey world in particular, symbolizes such deeply ingrained masculine ideals that the shock is greater there. Others will claim that the reactions were nowhere near as strong as the media would like to think, that it's all been exaggerated. One voice might say, obviously no one has anything against them. Another will add, you just don't want the town to be full of them. A few more will mutter, maybe it would be best if he moved for his own sake, because there isn't much for him here, is there? Better for him to go to a big city. For his sake, obviously. Not that I've got anything against them, not at all, but, you know. Some of the jokes online are probably just that, jokes. That will be the excuse. I always knew. My mom made me a meringue birthday cake when I was at primary school, and Benji only ate the bananas. Others are more insinuating. Wonder what he and Kevin got up to in the locker room when the others had all gone home. Everything that pours in after that is just more in the same vein. Text messages from pay-as-you-go cell phones and anonymous comments online. Fag, queer, homo, poof. Disgusting. It's not natural, you're sick. We always knew. No homos in Beartown. We're gonna find you and slice off your tattoo. The bear isn't some gay symbol. No rapists or queers in Beartown. You're sick, just like Kevin. Hope you get AIDS. Hope you die. Move away from here if you want to live. Next time, the knife will end up in you, not the door. Maya is sitting at home in front of her computer. She's reading everything the bastards are writing about Benji and remembers everything they've written about her. Nothing changes. Everything just starts again. Maya's dad used to listen to an old record where a guy sang about everything having cracks in it, because that's how the light gets in. Maya looks at the pictures of Benji and the teacher over and over again, but it's not Benji and the teacher she's looking at. Back in the summer, when she was on the island with Anna, Maya played music on Anna's phone, something with guitars and sad singing, and Anna yelled, "No junky music on my island!" And Maya giggled as she held the phone out of reach and yelled, "No bleep bleep music in the forest! It's environmental pollution!" Anna tried to snatch her phone back. Maya jumped out of the way but ended up dropping it, and it hit a rock. The glass of the camera lens cracked, not much, but just enough so that all of Anna's pictures from then on have a little line up in one corner. Maya expected Anna to be angry, but she just laughed and said, "Now I'm going to see that crack in every photo I take, so you're going to be in all my pictures from now on, you idiot." Maya loved her best friend for that. But now she sits alone in front of her computer, looking at the pictures of Benji and the teacher over and over again, and all she can see is that little line up in the top corner. The same line in every picture. A tiny, almost invisible crack, where all the darkness gets out. Long afterward, none of us will be able to prove exactly who said what or where the different photographs that ended up online actually came from. But everyone has the chance to see the pictures of Benji kissing the teacher. A lot of people don't care, but they're silent, so only the others are heard. And that will be their excuse. They care, that's all. About the town, about the hockey team, about Benjamin himself. They care about the school. They care about the children. A group of parents phone the headmaster, demanding a meeting. Magan Leet, William's mother, is one of them. She's on the Parent-Teacher Association. She's just doing her job. It's nothing personal. As she points out at the meeting, we don't harbor any ill will to anyone. We're just concerned parents. But she demands that obviously the teacher must be dismissed. Not because he's different, of course not. But we can't tolerate the fact that he's had sexual relations with a pupil, not after everything that's happened. First the rape, and now this? It doesn't really make any difference if it's a boy or a girl. Surely everyone should be treated equally. Things are always connected when it suits us. How will we be able to feel safe with this teacher educating our children now that we are aware of his agenda? One parent wonders. When the headmaster asks exactly what the parent means by agenda, Magan Leet snaps, you know exactly what we mean. What about this, then? Another parent cries, tossing a sheet of paper onto the headmaster's desk. It was on a notice board in the corridor. So that teacher, Jeanette, is going to teach pupils how to fight, Magan Leet adds. It's martial arts. She's offering the pupils training in, the headmaster says, but is predictably interrupted. Violence. Training in violence. So one teacher has sexual relationships with his pupils, and another wants to fight with them? What sort of school are you running here, exactly? Then Magan Leet says, I'm going to call the council. And she does. The first counselor who answers is Richard Tiu. Maya bangs on the door of Anna's house so hard that the dogs start barking, as if she wants to tear the building apart. Anna opens the door, pale and lifeless, crushed and full of self-loathing. But Maya is too angry to stop her fury. She just yells, You took those pictures! How could you do that? Anna is panting hysterically, sobbing and sniffing so hard she can barely get her words out. I kissed him, Maya. I kissed him. He could have said something because I just thought he had a girlfriend, but I kissed him. If he'd only said he was... Maya doesn't let her finish. She just shakes her head and spits on the ground between herself and her best friend. And then she isn't that anymore. You're just like everyone else in this town, Anna. As soon as you don't get what you want, you think you have the right to hurt other people. Anna is crying so hard that she can't stand up. She collapses in the doorway. Maya doesn't catch her. She's already walking away. Perhaps what everyone says is true. Perhaps it isn't personal. Perhaps it's just the last straw for a few people who have long felt that they're living with their backs against the wall. Jobs are disappearing. The politicians are corrupt. The hospital is going to be closed down, and the factory is changing owners. Reporters show up here only when something negative happens, and all they ever want is to be able to depict the inhabitants as backward and prejudiced. But perhaps some people around here feel that there's just too much politics all at the same time. Too much change forced upon hard-working people who have already been through enough. Maybe it's nothing to do with Benji or the teacher or Elizabeth Zakel or anyone else. Perhaps the people posting online are just isolated malcontents. Perhaps no one meant any harm. In the heat of the action, people have a tendency to overreact, that's all. Perhaps we'll explain it by saying that there were too many things going on at once. It was a complex issue, and people have to be allowed to respond emotionally. It's always the aggressor's feelings we have to defend, as if they're the ones who need our understanding. The news that a teacher at the school has had a long-term relationship with a pupil, and is now suspended while the matter is investigated, quickly reaches the local paper. At first, the comments section is cautious, but soon the questions start. Do you think this is a coincidence, then? First that coach, and now a teacher? No one says woman. No one says homosexual. Everyone says people like that. Like them. Someone writes, And you're not allowed to complain, either, because then you're made out to be the bad guy. But surely we have to be allowed to react for the sake of the children. What sort of town do we want to live in? Why do we have to be some sort of experiment for everything? Most of them don't even mention Benji. That makes it easier. But a picture appears. The first time it is published is from an anonymous online account. No one remembers where. And as soon as it starts to spread, the account is deleted. No one asks where the picture came from. Rumors spread out in all directions, but it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is what the picture shows. It's a hockey helmet. It looks as though it's been photographed on a bench in a locker room, and on the side is a picture of the bear, the logo of Beartown Hockey. A rainbow has been painted around it. Someone writes anonymously, "I think it looks great. I don't even like hockey, but I think we should take the opportunity to do something symbolic with the whole club to show our support. Like a political gesture, hand in hand with hockey." Then the picture spreads beyond Beartown, and a newspaper in a big city posts it on its website with the caption, "Hockey player comes out as gay. This is his club's admirable response." By the time the reactions start to appear, Richard Tew has already closed his laptop. He's closed the window after letting out the last of the flies. It's cold out there, and they'll soon freeze to death. But they've had their summer, served their purpose. As Richard Tew is leaving his office, someone is already writing online, "Beartown isn't going to become some bullshit rainbow town. And Beartown ice hockey isn't going to become some bullshit rainbow team. The pack will never allow that to happen." When the image turns out to be a fake, manipulated using a common computer program, reporters from all over the country start calling the general manager of Beartown ice hockey, asking, "Why don't you want to show support for homosexual players? Why have you distanced yourself from those helmets with the rainbow flag on them?" Peter Anderson tries to explain, without knowing what he really wants to say. Everything is going so fast. In the end, he doesn't dare answer his phone anymore. But when the reporter from the local paper calls Richard Tew and asks what he thinks of all the turbulence surrounding Beartown ice hockey, naturally Tew has a very simple answer. "I don't think we should mix hockey and politics. Just let the guys play." That will be heard more and more often in coming days. Just let the guys play. It will mean different things to different people. Maya gets home to a house where the only sound is the gentle tapping of a computer mouse and keyboard. Leo is sitting in his room, so close to the screen that the world disappears, as usual. Maya is envious of his escape route. "What are you doing?" she asks, ridiculously. "Playing a game," he replies. She stands in the doorway for a few moments, opens her mouth as if to ask something, but nothing comes out. So she shuts the door and walks toward the kitchen. Perhaps he can hear from her footsteps that something's wrong, unless little brothers just know things that other people miss, because without taking his eyes from the computer, he calls, "Do you want to play?" Chapter 32. Then he takes the shotgun and goes out into the forest. Hockey is the simplest sport in the world, if you're sitting in the stands. It's always so easy to say what everyone should have done when you know that what they actually did didn't work. Peter heads to the rink with tunnel vision. His phone is still ringing, but he's stopped answering. He tries calling Benji, but Benji doesn't answer. He opens his email. It's an avalanche. He slumps forward, blinded by a migraine, unable to breathe. For a few minutes, he worries that he's having a stroke. He can still remember the terrible emails and text messages that appeared after Maya reported Kevin to the police. It's starting again. It's all happening again. Most of them don't use the word itself. They use words such as distraction and politics instead. "We just don't want any distractions or politics in the club so close to the game against Yed, Peter." Everyone means well, obviously. No one has anything against Benji, of course. But for the boy's own sake, perhaps it's best if he has a little break. You know how sensitive some people, not us, but there are others who might react negatively, Peter. We're only thinking of the boys' best.
Naturally.
Just let the guys play, several correspondents urge. Just not all the guys. But one of the emails is different. It comes from one of the parents of the Little League players, and there's a picture attached, taken in the A-team's locker room, but it's not of Benji. It shows Elizabeth Zakel, who appears to be leaning forward and examining Bobo's genitals. It may have been a harmless joke when it happened, but someone on the A-team took a photograph. No one knows how the picture spread, but there's another email containing the same picture. Then another one appears. First, teachers sleeping with their pupils, then teachers training their pupils to fight, and now this? The emails that follow stick to the usual progression. First worried emails, then hate-filled emails, then threatening emails, finally an anonymous email. If that bitch and that queer take part in one more Beartown training session, you're going to be in serious trouble. It's so easy to be wise in hindsight. Hockey is so simple from the stands. If Peter hadn't had a daughter who had been depicted as the enemy of the entire hockey club back in the spring, he might have reacted better now. Or perhaps worse. But his instincts are heading in all different directions, so in the end he prints out the picture of Zakel and Bobo, finds the coach down on the ice, and shouts, Zakel, what's this? Zakel is standing on her own, shooting pucks, and she skates calmly over to the boards and looks at the picture. That's me, and that's Bobo, and that little thing is a penis. But you, it's, what's... Zakel taps her stick on the ice, shrugs. You know how it is. Hockey teams test the boundaries when they get a new coach. It's between them and me. Peter is clutching his head as if it's cracked, and he's glued it back together and is waiting for it to dry. But, Zakel, it isn't between you and them anymore. Someone's posted the picture online. The whole town is going... Zakel examines the tape on her stick. I'm a hockey coach. I'm not the mayor. The town's problems are the town's problems. In here, we just play hockey. Peter groans. Society doesn't work like that, Zakel. People will interpret this as they're not used to... First this business with Benji, and now this with you and this... penis? Zakel suggests helpfully. Peter glares at her. We've received a threat. We have to cancel today's practice. Zakel doesn't seem to hear him, and asks instead, What's happening with Vidar, our new goalie? Are you going to let him play? Did you hear what I said? We've received a threat. Never mind about Vidar. We have to cancel practice. Zakel shrugs again. I heard. I'm not deaf. She goes back out onto the ice, as if he's finished. Then she calmly carries on firing pucks. Peter storms up to the office and calls the A-team players. They all answer apart from Benji. Peter explains the threat in the email. All the players understand. Not one of them stays at home. When the practice begins, the team gathers on the ice in front of Zakel. She taps her stick on the ice and says, Have you heard that the club's received a threat? They nod. She clarifies, If I coach you and if Benjamin plays with us, apparently we're going to be in serious trouble. So if you don't want to train today, I won't hold it against you. No one moves. A lot of shit has been said about this team, but they don't scare easily. Zakel nods. Well then, I understand that there are a lot of emotions right now, but we're a hockey team. We play hockey. The older players wait for her to demand to know who posted the picture of her and Bobo on the internet. She doesn't even mention it. Perhaps that wins her some respect because eventually one of them calls out, We mostly turned up for the beer. The laughter that follows is liberating. Even Bobo looks a little less embarrassed. It's only words. Combinations of letters. How can they possibly hurt anyone? Benji is standing in Audrey's kennels. The dogs are playing in the snow around his feet. They don't care, and he wishes no one else did either. He doesn't want to change the world, doesn't want anyone to have to adapt themselves to him. He just wants to play hockey. Go into the locker room without it falling silent because nobody dares to mess around anymore. He just wants all the usual things. Sticks and ice, a puck and two nets. The desire to win, to struggle. You against us, with everything we've got. But that's over now. Benji is no longer one of them. Perhaps one day he'll find words for that feeling of being different. How physical it is. Exclusion is a form of exhaustion that eats its way into your skeleton. People who are like everyone else, who belong to the norm, the majority, can't possibly understand it. How can they? Benji has heard all the arguments. He's sat next to adults in the stands and in buses on the way to tournaments. People who say, there are no homosexuals in ice hockey. There were jokes, all the usual stuff, but that never really affected Benji. It was the little choices of vocabulary that everyone seemed to find obvious that cut deepest, when fag was used as an insult. You play like fags. Fag referee. Damn fag coffee machine doesn't work. Three little letters used to describe weakness, stupidity, anything that didn't function properly, anything that was defective. Naturally, there were adults who never said the word. Some of them said other things instead. They didn't even think about it, but Benji stored up tiny splinters of conversations for years. They don't bother with hockey. How would that even work? With the locker room and everything? Are we going to have three different locker rooms just in case? The people saying these things were ordinary parents, kind and generous people who did all they could for their children's hockey team. They didn't vote for extremist parties. They didn't wish anyone dead. They'd never dream of being violent. They just said obvious, self-evident things such as, people like that probably don't feel at home in hockey. They probably like other things. You have to bear in mind that hockey's a tough sport. Sometimes they said it straight out. Hockey's a sport for men. They said men, but even as a small boy, Benji would stand alongside in silence, knowing that what they actually meant was real men. It's only words, only letters, only a human being. Benji doesn't train with his team today, because he knows he's no longer one of them. He doesn't know who he ought to be instead, and he doesn't know if he wants that. When the practice starts, Suna is sitting in the stands. Peter sinks down beside him. Have you reported the threat to the police? Suna asks. They don't know if it's serious or not. Could just be some kid. Try not to worry. I don't know what to do, Peter admits impotently. Suna doesn't offer any comfort. He never does. He demands that people take responsibility. You don't know what to do or what you ought to do. Peter sighs. You know what I mean. It's a messy situation to try to handle. Zakel and the team. Suna nods toward the ice. They chose to come. Let the guys play. What about Benjamin, then? How am I going to help him? Suna adjusts the fold of his t-shirt over his stomach. You can start by giving up the idea that he needs help. It's everyone else who needs help. Peter snaps back, hurt. Don't come here and try to tell me that I'm preg... Suna snorts. Why are you still involved in this sport, Peter? Peter takes a deep breath. I don't know how to stop. Suna nods. I tell myself that I'm still here because the ice is the only place I know where everyone is equal. Out there, it doesn't matter who you are. All that matters is if you can play. There may be equality on the ice, but the same thing doesn't apply to the sport in general, Peter. No. And that's our fault. Yours and mine and everyone else's. Peter throws his arms out. But what are we supposed to do? Suna raises an eyebrow. We see to it that the next kid who says he's different in some way is met with a shrug of the shoulders. We need to say, so what? That doesn't matter, does it? And one day perhaps there won't be homosexual hockey players and female coaches. just hockey players and coaches. The community isn't that simple, Peter says.
The community?
We are the community, Suna replies. Peter rubs his eyes.
Please, Suna. I've had reporters calling me for hours now. Hell, maybe they're right. Maybe we ought to do something symbolic for Benjamin. If we painted our helmets, would that help?
Suna leans back in his seat. Do you think that's what Benjamin wants?
He chose not to tell anyone. Some lowlife gave it away. I'm sure loads of journalists would like to make him into some sort of figurehead now, and loads of nutters on the other side will want to vent all their hatred on him. And neither side knows a damn thing about hockey. They'll turn every game he plays in into a battle between their conflicting agendas, a political circus. And that may be what he's most frightened of, becoming a burden to the team, a distraction.
Peter snaps back in frustration. So what do you think Benjamin wants us to do then?
Nothing.
We have to do something.
Do you care about his sexuality? Does it change the way you look at him?
Of course not.
Suna pats Peter on the shoulder. I'm a silly old man, Peter. I don't always know what's right and what's wrong. But Benjamin has been the cause of a lot of crap outside this ice rink over the years. Fighting and smoking dope and God knows what else. But he's a damn good player. So you and everyone else has said every time, that has nothing to do with hockey. So why should this have anything to do with hockey? Let the boy live his life. Don't force him to become a figurehead. If we're uncomfortable with his sexuality, then he's not the one with the damn problem. We are.
Peter flushes and swallows. I didn't mean...
Suna scratches his remaining hair.
Secrets weigh a person down. Can you imagine what it must have been like to carry around that secret about yourself your whole life? Hockey was his refuge. The ice may have been the only place where he felt just the same as everyone else. Don't take that away from him.
So what do I do?
Let him earn his place in the team on the strength of his hockey alone, just like everyone else. He's going to be treated differently everywhere else now. Don't let that happen to him here.
Peter says nothing for a long time. Then he says, You've always said we should be more than just a hockey club, Suna. Isn't that exactly what we should be now?
Suna considers this.
Eventually he whispers sadly,
Maybe.
Like I said, Peter, I'm an old man. I don't know what the hell I'm saying half the time.
Benji isn't his father. He doesn't do what Elan Ovich did. He doesn't leave any gifts, doesn't give any signs or symbols. His mom and sisters call him. They've read the same things online as everyone else, and they're worried. So he says everything's okay. He's good at that. He goes to Audrey's kennels because one of the dogs was ill last night. Audrey got home late from the vets and is still asleep. Benji closes the door downstairs just hard enough to wake his sister from her slumber, and she falls asleep again straight away. Audrey only ever sleeps really deeply if she knows her little brother is home. Otherwise, it's just anxious dozing. Benji takes the garbage out, folds his bedsheets, and puts them neatly into a cupboard the way she's always nagging at him to do. Then he goes out to see the dogs. They're also asleep when he goes silently upstairs, knowing exactly which floorboards creak and which ones don't, like a boy taking part in the world's slowest game of hopscotch. He very carefully slides his hand under Audrey's pillow and takes the key. He kisses his sister's forehead for the last time. Then he takes the shotgun and goes out into the forest. After practice, Zakel stands in the parking lot smoking a cigar. Peter comes outside, stops beside her, and asks, Do you really want Vidar on the team? She lets the smoke out through her nose.
Yes.
Peter groans.
Hold an open tryout, then. Say that anyone who hasn't got a contract with another club can attend. If Vidar is good enough, he can play. But he only gets his place if his hockey's good enough, like everyone else.
Peter opens the door to go back inside, but Zekhel asks, Why are you so angry with Vidar? Is it normal to be that angry if someone shits on your desk?
Peter suppresses his gag reflex at the thought of Vidar's visiting card. He ended up with shit between the keys on his computer keyboard, and that's not the sort of thing you get rid of easily, either from the keyboard or from your memory.
But he shakes his head.
Vidar's unreliable. A team has to be able to rely on its goalie, but Vidar is completely unpredictable. Egotistical. You can't build a team made up of egoists.
So why have you changed your mind? Zekhel asks.
Peter doesn't know what to say, so he replies honestly. I want this to be a club where we make people better. Maybe we can make Vidar a better person. Maybe ourselves too.
The snowflakes turn somersaults in the wind, and Peter is horrified that he has realized this too late. Benji might never come back. You can say a lot of things about Benjamin Ovitch, but he was never an egoist. It will be claimed that this happened to one person. It will be a lie. We will say, things like this are no one's fault, but of course they are. Deep down, we will know the truth. It's plenty of people's fault. Ours. Chapter 33. Not Waking Up. Benji is deeper in the forest than ever when he finally stops. The snow is still falling, its flakes tentatively brushing his skin before melting with his body heat and trickling angrily through the hairs on his lower arms. The freezing temperature colors his cheeks, his fingers stiffen around the rifle, the breath from his mouth forms smaller and smaller clouds. In the end, he isn't breathing at all. There's a long period of silence. Then a single shot echoes between the trees. In Beartown, we bury those we love beneath our most beautiful trees. It's a child who finds the body. But the child doesn't walk calmly through Beartown the way Audrey did when she found her father, Alan Ovitch, all those years ago. This child is running. Amit and Bobo are sitting in the locker room. They'll remember this as their last conversation, their last raucous laughter, before they found out that someone had died. It will feel as if they'll never really be able to laugh as loud ever again.
What do girls find sexy? Bobo asks.
He says it the way he says everything, as if his brain is a coffee machine that someone has forgotten to put a coffee pot under. So his thoughts drip straight onto the hot plate beneath and spray everywhere.
How should I know? Amit says helplessly.
It's not long since Bobo asked if it was true that contact lenses are made out of jellyfish. Another time he wondered,
You know how it's supposed to be unlucky to leave your keys on the table?
Okay, but what if someone borrows my keys and leaves them on a table when I'm not even there? Do I still get the bad luck? Back in the spring, he wanted to know,
How do you know if you've got a nice-looking dick?
At school the other day, he asked Amit,
How long should shorts be?
Then almost immediately afterward,
You know, in a vacuum, like in space, if you cry there, what happens to your tears?
I heard some girls in school say an actor was sexy because he had a defined chin and high cheekbones.
How do you know if you've got those?
I'm sure you have, Amit says.
You think?
Bobo says hopefully. His face is as shapeless as an overboiled potato, but Amit still nods kindly.
I'm sure you're sexy, Bobo. Thanks,
Bobo says, clearly relieved, as if he can tick that off his list of things to worry about. Then he asks,
Have you ever been anyone's best friend?
Amit groans.
Please, Bobo.
Yes, of course I've had a best friend. Bobo shakes his big head.
No, I mean, have you been someone's best friend?
I've had lots of best friends, but I don't think I've ever been anyone else's best friend.
Do you understand what I mean?
Amit scratches his ear.
Can I be honest? I hardly ever understand what the hell you're going on about.
Bobo starts to laugh. So does Amit. The loudest, most uproarious laughter for a long time. You're never alone in the forest. All the children around here learn that. Benji stops dead when he sees the animal appear, 30 feet away. Benji looks it right in the eye. He's hunted in these forests all his life, but this is the first time he's seen such a large bear. Benji has been walking into the wind. It hasn't caught his scent. The bear is close enough to feel threatened, and Benji has no chance of running. All the children around here learn the same things when they're small. Don't run, don't scream. If the bear runs toward you, curl up on the ground and play dead, and cover your head with your backpack. Don't fight until you're sure you have no other choice. The rifle is shaking in Benji's hands. He shouldn't fire. The animal's heart and lungs are shielded by its powerful shoulders. Only extremely skilled hunters stand any chance of shooting a bear and staying alive long enough to talk about it afterward. Benji ought to know better. But his heart is pounding. He hears his own voice roar from the depths, and then he fires into the air. Or directly at the bear, he doesn't remember. And it vanishes. It doesn't run away. It doesn't slope off into the forest. It just vanishes. Benji stands in the snow, and the forest eats up the echo of the shot until nothing remains but the wind. And he isn't at all sure if he's dreaming. If there really was a bear, or if he imagined it, a genuine threat or an imaginary one. He goes over to where the bear ought to have been standing, but there are no tracks in the snow. Even so, he can still feel its stare, like when you wake up early in the morning and don't have to open your eyes to know that the person next to you is looking at you. Benji is breathing hard. There's a sense of invincibility about deciding to die and then not going through with it. A sense of power over yourself. He walks home with a feeling that his body doesn't belong to him, without knowing who's going to inhabit it now. But at least he goes home. Amit and Bobo are still laughing. But Bobo stops abruptly before Amit has time to realize what's happened. Bobo has always been told that he's a bit slow on the uptake. He knows all the jokes by heart. That boy couldn't pour water out of a boot if it had holes in the toes and the instructions under the heel. And Bobo's so stupid he can't piss his own name in the snow. But that doesn't mean his brain isn't busy. His mom always says that it just works in a different way from other people's. So Bobo has been expecting this. Outside, he may appear unfocused. But inside, he has been preparing for this moment ever since his mom took him out into the forest and told him she was ill. The child runs through Beartown, in through the door of the ice rink, gesticulating wildly at the people who ask where she's going. Some of them recognize her. It's Bobo's little sister. One of them may even have realized and whispered, "Oh no." When his little sister stands in the doorway of the locker room sobbing, "She's not waking up, Bobo. Dad's gone to get a car, and Mom won't wake up, even though I've tried shouting at her." Bobo has already dealt with his own grief. His tears trickle into his little sister's hair, but mostly for her sake. She was brave enough to run through the whole town, but she's in pieces now, and there's no one she trusts as much as her big brother. Only then does the girl feel safe enough in his arms to dare to shatter into a billion pieces. She will always run to Bobo when she feels sad, all her life, and he stands with his arms around her and knows that he has to be strong enough to bear that responsibility now. Amit hugs them both, but Bobo doesn't feel it. He's already wondering about how he's going to find a tree beautiful enough for his mom to sleep under. That's when he becomes an adult. Adriovich wakes up from a terrible dream. She fumbles in a daze under her pillow and feels her pulse throb in her temples when her fingers finally close around the key. She's breathing so hard that it hurts. She goes downstairs and finds her little brother sleeping on the sofa. The rifle is standing in the gun cabinet, as if nothing had ever happened. She kisses him on the forehead, sits on the floor beside him for hours. Can't quite seem to get beyond just waking up. Chapter 34. Violence against a horse on official service. In many years' time, we may not know what to call this story. We will say it was a story about violence, about hate, about conflict and difference and communities that tore themselves apart. But that won't be true, at least not entirely. It's also a different sort of story. Vida Arrhenius is in his last year as a teenager. His psychologist's report suggests that he has a lack of impulse control, but most people would probably expand that to say a complete lack. He's always gotten into fights. Sometimes he and his big brother Tima tried to defend their mother, and sometimes they defended each other. And if there wasn't anyone to defend, they would fight with each other. The bit about impulse control is true. Vidar has never been able to stop himself. About the time that other people get an idea into their heads along the lines of, I wonder what would happen if... Vidar would already have done it. When Vidar was a boy, his coach once said that was what made him such a good goalie. You just don't know how to not stop those pucks. Everyone says that Vidar's problem is that he doesn't think, but the opposite is actually the case. He can't stop thinking. He was 12 years old when he realized that he was alone. He went to another town with his brother and his brother's friends when the Beartown A-team was playing an away game there. After the game, Tima told Vidar to go to McDonald's and wait there, because he had a feeling there was going to be trouble. Vidar was sitting there eating when a group of opposing fans burst in through the doors. Tima and the pack had been stopped by the police, and Vidar was sitting alone in a corner dressed in the wrong colors, and the opposing fans knew who he was. During the game, they had seen the 12-year-old yelling insults about their club and giving them the finger. You're not so tough without your brother, are you? They cried as they attacked him. That was when Vidar realized he was on his own. Everyone is. We are born alone, die alone, and fight alone. So Vidar fought. He thought he was going to die. He watched adults leave the fast food restaurant. He might have been a child, but no one tried to help him. The staff ran to the kitchen. He didn't know how many enemies there were. All he knew was that he didn't stand a chance. He lashed out anyway. Then Spider appeared out of nowhere. Vidar's memory has him jumping through a window, but who knows? Spider defended him as if they were family, and after that, they were. That was when Vidar realized that you don't have to be alone. Not all the time. Not if you have a pack. When Vidar was 16, they were at another away game. Spider had been found guilty of a number of minor offenses and was on probation. He and Vidar waited in a park while the rest of the pack moved on, because Spider also had a head that was never quiet. And just like Vidar, he had realized that everything slowed down sometimes if you took the right drugs. The police came around the corner on horseback, saw the two suspected hooligans, and Spider panicked and ran. He had drugs on him, as did Vidar. Vidar could have outrun Spider, but Spider was on probation, and Vidar lacked impulse control. He couldn't help himself from protecting someone he loved. So while Spider ran off in one direction, Vidar ran in the other, toward the police. The charges filed against him afterward were numerous and varied. Vidar can't even remember them all. Possession of narcotics was one, he knows that much. Violently resisting a public official was another, he thinks. Then there was something about his hitting a police horse. Vidar has never really liked horses. Violence against a horse on official service? How long do they lock you up for that? That was how he ended up in the clinic, and that was where he met Baloo. He worked there and was called that because he was the same size and had the same posture as the bear in the Jungle Book. When they became friends, it was fairly natural that the sinewy, dark-haired Vidar would be given the nickname Mowgli. Perhaps that helped him, getting a different name.
Perhaps he was able to pretend to be a different person then. Baloo didn't say much, but he realized that Vidar had a lot of energy that needed a positive outlet if it wasn't to explode in a negative way. When he found out that the boy played hockey, he borrowed some goalie's gear, and every time the fuses in Vidar's head were threatening to explode in impulsive outbursts of rage about anything at all, Baloo would suggest calmly,
"Okay, Mowgli, let's go to the basement."
There was a storeroom in the basement, large enough for Baloo to stand by one wall, throwing tennis balls as hard as he could toward Vidar at the other end. After a month or so, Baloo laid a new floor, smooth enough to feel like ice, so he could fire real hockey pucks. They played as often as they could. Sometimes Baloo even broke the rules and played with Vidar at night. He did it because he hoped it would help Vidar to learn not to break all the other rules. Definitions of care and punishment are always changing, and Baloo did what he could to give them a defined shape. He rarely said much, but he was the one who protested loudest when Vidar was released.
"He's not ready," Baloo declared.
No one cared. Vidar had a powerful friend somewhere, someone who had made sure that all the documentation that was required suddenly materialized. So when Vidar left the unit, Baloo just whispered sadly to him,
"Stay on the ice, Mowgli. Concentrate on hockey."
Maya and Leo are sitting at the computer, and in her memory it will feel as though they spent several days playing. She holds the words inside her for as long as she can, but in the end she can't help saying,
"Don't fight for my sake again. I know you love me, but don't fight for my sake. Fight for other things if you must, but not for me."
"Okay," her little brother promises. They don't say much after that. But sometimes Leo gets something wrong and is so angry that he hits himself in the thigh and yells, "Idiot!" And then Maya laughs so loudly that her throat starts to hurt. A bit like old times for a short while. Simple. But then Maya gets something right in the game, and even Leo is impressed, so he turns to give her a high five. She doesn't react in time, and his hand hits her shoulder instead. Maya jumps so hard that she knocks her chair over as if he'd burned her. She stands there gasping, eyes wide open, and curses herself and tries to pretend it was nothing. But Leo has already understood. Sometimes little brothers do that. Hardly anyone has touched Maya since the rape. It doesn't matter that Leo is her brother. Fear isn't logical. The body reacts independently of the brain. Leo switches the computer off.
"Get your jacket,"
he says sternly.
"Why?"
Maya wonders sheepishly.
"I'm going to show you something."
When Vidar walks out from the unit, Tima, Woody, and Spider are waiting outside in a car. Tima has to give Spider a shove to get him to stop hugging Vidar. But he will never set foot in the apartment he has been given by the council's housing association.
"I have to live at home. I have to help you count," he tells his brother.
Tima kisses him on the head. The first thing Vidar wants to talk about? Beartown ice hockey. What does the team look like? What players have we got this year? Are we going to beat Hied? He's the team's keenest fan, and, after his mom's kitchen, the place he's missed most is the standing area in the rink. Tima can't stop patting his younger brother on the shoulder, and doesn't even tell Vidar that he won't need his place in the stand this year, that he's going to get a chance to play instead. Tima doesn't say anything because he doesn't want to make his brother nervous, and for a few short minutes his own happiness is pure and uncomplicated. He doesn't want to spoil that. Then Vidar asks about Benji Ovic. The last time the guys talked to Vidar, they told him that the new coach had made Ovic team captain, and they had been ecstatic at the time because they regarded Benji as one of them. A Beartown kid who stood tall, took one hit and meted out three in response. But when Vidar mentions his name, both Spider and Woody fall silent. Their eyes harden, their words are worse.
"We've found out something about him."
Vidar listens. The guys can't bring themselves to use Benji's name. They talk as if he'd died.
Perhaps he has, at least in part, the person they thought he was. He's no longer one of them. Vidar may be unlike most of the members of the pack because he doesn't care who the hell any-